Welcome back to the program. To date, there has not been a single prosecution, much less serious investigation by the Justice Department, into the events that almost brought the U.S. economy to its knees. The SEC has not fundamentally changed its rules. The Senate has repeatedly kowtowed to the big banks, and too big to fail is still the name of the game. Are these just random coincidences, or is Wall Street simply too powerful for any part of government to take on? And in fact, should it? Examining these issues today, we're joined by our guest, Jeff Connaughton. Jeff is a former staffer for Vice President Joe Biden, as well as a former chief of staff for ex-Senator Ted Kaufman. He also spent 12 years at one of Washington's top lobbying firms. It is my pleasure to welcome Jeff Connaughton here to talk about his new book, The Payoff, Why Wall Street Always Wins. Jeff Connaughton, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Jeff.
It's great to have you here. Well, we look at the fact that there has been no real serious investigation, no prosecution. How much of this could be laid at the reality that there was nothing that really violated the law, that there was nothing really to prosecute?
Well, we'll never know now for sure, because the Justice Department did not make a strong enough effort for us to credibly believe them when they say there was nothing there to prosecute. I mean, that's why I left town. That's why I wrote my book. I mean, my boss, Ted Kaufman, chaired two hearings, one in December 2009, one in September of 2010, on financial fraud prosecutions. And we met with senior Justice Department officials before each of those hearings, and it was clear to me in September 2009, 8 months after Attorney General Eric Holder had said at his swearing in that he would make investigating Wall Street a priority, that it would take drilling down with investigations to get to the bottom of whether there was any illegal behavior. 8 months later, it was clear to me that Central Justice had been completely passive, that they said, you know, Jeff, we're dependent on the pipeline to bring us these cases. You know, they were sitting back waiting, you know, for the cases to develop. Well, the pipeline itself wasn't working. I mean, at one end of the pipeline is supposed to be the bank regulatory agencies. And the bank regulatory agencies historically, like back during the savings and loan crisis, provided roadmaps for the FBI to use to investigate crime. Now we know from the top down, you know, during the LIBOR scandal, when Federal Reserve Chairman Bernanke and Treasury Secretary Geithner found out about potentially criminal bank behavior, they did next to nothing, and it happened at lower levels of the bank regulatory agencies as well. They're just not helping to police fraud. In fact, they're almost complicit in the fraud. I mean, let me just make one more point, and then I'll let you ask a question.
Sure,
I mean, think back to 4 years ago when Lehman Brothers did go bankrupt. I mean, we all saw on TV all the Lehman Brothers employees walking out of their building carrying boxes of documents and personal effects. That was the first sign that there was no document retention order in place by the bank regulatory agencies to prevent, you know, the Lehman executives from walking out with what might have been pertinent information for subsequent investigations.
How much of this comes out of fear that to really engage in those investigations would have an adverse effect on the U.S. economy itself as a result of investigating these banks? How much of it comes out of what is seen in many quarters as simply the powerful influence of these banks and institutions?
Well, there's no doubt that when you go back to March 2009, that our government, appropriately so, was very deeply concerned about the fragility of the international financial system. They had no idea where these credit default swaps went. I mean, they were showing up in Iceland and Royal Bank of Scotland. I mean, it was, they were concerned. But, and I think the Justice Department sort of interpreted that concern as an injunction, you know, not to throw any banker in the brig until we've righted our financial ship. But that was a false choice. They don't have to indict the firm as a firm. I mean, when Arthur Andersen was indicted, the accounting firm, in the Enron fraud scandal, Arthur Andersen went out of business the next day. I mean, it evaporated or vaporized Arthur Andersen. You can pursue individuals. You know, the Justice Department could have pursued culpable individuals, and that wouldn't have done anything to slow the ability of the banking community to recover. Indeed, today, if the culpable individuals had been held accountable, we'd have more trust in our banking system. I mean, now we have a Justice Department that has a credibility problem, and Main Street, you know, even if there were only a few bad apples on Wall Street, thinks the whole barrel is rotten. There's just no individual, you know, deterrence against financial fraud happening now.
But would going against individuals simply be scapegoating? Is, in fact, the whole culture of the place so pervasive that it is institutionalized?
No, I don't agree with that. I mean, because that's too close to the everyone was doing it argument, you know, that we were in a Dutch tulip craze, if you will, and, you know, when everyone is sort of operating in an asset bubble, you know, it's rational to just keep buying Dutch tulips for, you know, $2,000 and trying to flip them for $2,100. I don't think it was and everyone was doing it. I think there was fraud at the basic mortgage origination level that at some point, as those mortgages were being packaged and resold and securitized by Wall Street, there was knowledge that those, even though they had been stamped AAA by credit rating agencies, that there was fraudulent mortgages through and through, and that you could have singled out individuals who knew, or at least at the highest levels of the firm, were responsible for countenancing that kind of behavior.
Was there concern on the part of the Justice Department that they couldn't make those prosecutions stick? Was there a certain fear of failing in the prosecution?
There was some of that in that in fall of 2008, there was one case brought by the Bush Justice Department against two bankers at Bear Stearns, and the jury came back with a not guilty verdict. So some have speculated that that did chill prosecutors from trying. But that shouldn't have been an excuse to just not bring any additional prosecutions. I mean, I think there was a mindset among the Justice Department leadership not to be proactive. Now, I saw it. I mean, you know, not to be aggressive, not to be creative with the types of criminal theories they could have used in these cases. I mean, we passed tough criminal sanctions in the Sarbanes-Oxley Act after the last round of fraud, Enron and MCI. Why didn't they use some of those provisions? You know, and the people that are at the top of the Justice Department come from these big white shoe defense-oriented law firms in Washington. And I just think they were too willing to buy the argument being put forward by the counsel for the potential defendants that, you know, look, you're going to lose this case because of X, Y, or Z. I mean, you know, they just simply weren't aggressive enough.
In not being aggressive enough because they thought they were going to lose, how much of it goes to then the whole issue of the influence that these banks have, the money that they give to political campaigns?
Yeah, well, you know, some of it was the Justice Department thinking they might lose. Some of it, I believe, was the administration just making a decision early on, which the Justice Department picked up on. Now, of course, I don't have direct evidence of that, to just not go after Wall Street hard because economic recovery was the priority. And, you know, that they, and that the people who were, you know, Tim Geithner has made public statements where he has said, you know, that those sorts of things that would give people the most satisfaction, you know, Old Testament justice, you know, penalizing the venal, are not the things that would sort of best lead to, you know, economic recovery. And that type of a statement tends to indicate that his attitude is that utilitarian outcomes, you know, will all be better off the sooner the banking community is allowed to recover because that'll help fuel the economic recovery. I mean, if that is his justification for overlooking potentially criminal bank behavior, you know, I mean, that's just wrong. Again, it's a false choice. I mean, we could do both. You know, in fact, in the long run, you'll have a sounder economy if people think the rule of law actually means something in our financial markets.
In many ways, it seems that it was a process of unintended consequences, that initially it was exactly what you're saying, that Geithner said that they didn't want to do anything to jeopardize the financial recovery. Then after enough time had gone by, it was, well, let's not bother. Nobody has the stomach for it anymore. We don't want to open up all of those old wounds.
Well, it's clear that when you're talking about sophisticated, complex financial crimes, it would have taken a timely, all-in effort from the beginning of this administration to really do it. I mean, you would have had to have thrown, I mean, Chris Swecker, who was the assistant director of FBI, who testified in 2004 that fraud was going epidemic in the mortgage market, has been saying recently, now that he's left the FBI, that there just wasn't enough effort, you know, at the beginning of this administration. And, you know, we knew that in Congress, that they needed additional resources. That's why we passed the Fraud Enforcement and Recovery Act, which the president signed into law in May of 2009, which authorized, you know, tens of millions of additional dollars for more FBI agents and more prosecutors to prosecute this. But, you know, when they were slow to get started, slow to centralize it, I mean, the task force, we haven't even talked about it. I mean, the president first announced the task force in November of 2009. It added nothing. I mean, it was nothing but a press release collection agency. I mean, it amplified small fry mortgage broker cases that were already being prosecuted at the local U.S. attorney level. It didn't add anything at the sort of central level to muscle up a centralized effort. It was just something to show and tell Congress when Ted's first hearing was held in December. And you're right. I mean, you know, after a year or two goes by, and there's been no sort of effective strategic investigation underway, it's almost too late at that point.
It also seemed clear at various points that there simply wasn't the political will to do this. Talk a little about that.
Yeah, that's, you know, I mean, I'm in New York right now, and I've been talking to some pretty sophisticated people in New York making two points. You know, one, there's no effective rule of law on Wall Street right now, and two, neither political party is determined to do anything about it because of the vast amounts of money they're both trying to raise from Wall Street. And some of the people in New York say to me, Jeff, on those two points, not only are you right, but everyone in New York knows you're right. I mean, Mitt Romney in a presidential debate is not going to turn to Barack Obama and say, your Justice Department failed to prosecute Wall Street executives. If I'm elected president, I promise that the powerful will have to live by the same set of rules as everyone else. I mean, he's just not going to do it. Both, you know, neither campaign talked about it at their conventions. Now, President Obama did say he wants an America where Main Street lives by, Wall Street lives by the same set of rules as Wall Street. It's just like, that's not true, Mr. President. You know you haven't done enough to make sure that it's true.
It's nice to know there's something that we can find bipartisan agreement on.
Right. Well, and it's what's so frustrating to the Occupy people, to the, you know, to everyone who has sort of figured this out. There's nowhere to go in the political system if you're upset about this. There's no choice. There's no current political apparatus that appeals to people who are disillusioned by this problem. And I think it's going to take, you know, it takes power to beat power. It's going to take non-financial U.S. corporate America waking up and realizing that the American economy cannot succeed without long periods of financial stability. I mean, we can't afford to have financial crises in this country every 3 to 5 years. I mean, no one will be able to make any money if we're always getting knocked on our heels by yet another Wall Street crisis. So at some point, you know, Occupy, Tea Party, you know, both talk about crony capitalism, but also the business community itself, you know, we'll have to come together and insist, you know, that meaningful structural reforms take place, meaning, you know, tough regulators get named to lead the Justice Department so that, you know, we restore some semblance of accountability of law in Wall Street.
Traditionally, it has often been market forces that really made a difference, that it was important to bring broad-based public confidence back to the markets, and that was the reason reforms or investigations have taken place historically. In this case, that doesn't seem to matter.
Well, millions of people have taken their money out of the stock market. You can say it's because they were scared away by the precipitous drop, or it's because they've lost all trust and confidence in the markets. They think that it's rigged. You know, I think that's a real problem for America. I mean, I know my grandmother, you know, never made more money than, you know, what a secretary gets paid, yet she used to, you know, tear her paper towels in half and save every dime she could so she could invest it in the stock market for her retirement. And by the time she retired, she was almost worth $1 million. I mean, that's part of the American dream. And if people, you know, instead are keeping their money in CDs, which thanks to Federal Reserve policies currently pay next to nothing in interest rates, you know, it makes it much harder to develop a nest egg that is going to allow you to retire at a reasonable age. So we need confidence in our financial markets. I mean, I agree with you. Market forces are going to play an even more important role than the Justice Department, which is sort of playing no role right now. I mean, it's going to take the customers of Wall Street to get back to doing due diligence, which they kind of stopped doing, you know, during the mortgage craze, and the customers of these Wall Street banks holding them accountable. I mean, I think that'll have more to do with changing the behavior of the banks than the government in the short term.
It's interesting, though, that we see even a lack of due diligence among institutional investors in the IPO market, for example. I mean, the idea of due diligence in general seems to have gone into remission.
Right. I mean, this is what shocked even Alan Greenspan. I mean, he believed that you don't, you know, he's written before that you don't need fraud actions brought by regulators because parties to transactions have all the self-interested motivation they need to do the due diligence to ensure that they're not, you know, buying a fraudulent ticket from someone selling it to them. That broke down. You know, he was surprised that that happened. He was surprised that the executives of these Wall Street banks would take such risky positions that it put their very institutions at risk of going under. I mean, he thought their self-interest would be, you know, to ensure that, you know, the bank itself would survive. But, you know, we had a systemic breakdown in this country that led to the, you know, dramatic financial crisis. And as Greenspan said, a lot of the edifices of our economic system and our assumptions crumbled. And we've got to rebuild them, and we're not doing an effective enough job of rebuilding them, because for me, it all starts with law and order.
Why have the banks and these institutions been allowed to become so powerful? Why is it that Jamie Dimon has more influence in Congress than the President of the United States?
Right. Well, they say they've become so big because that's what their customers want, that to compete globally, you know, U.S. corporations need the services of gigantic mega banks. That's just not true. There are no economies of scale for banking over $100 billion. Again, going back to Alan Greenspan, he said that the Federal Reserve has done studies looking for what size banks, you know, where does economy of scope and scale top out, and it's around $100 billion. You know, J.P. Morgan is a $2 trillion bank. We don't need banks of that size. And when they become that big, they become very powerful. And they, you know, the six largest banks in the United States just 15 years ago had total assets equal to 17% of the United States gross domestic product. Today, the six largest banks, total assets, two-thirds of our GDP. They are indeed too big to fail. They're too big to manage. They're too big to regulate. They're too big to prosecute. And they're incredibly politically powerful. You know, look at what they're doing right now in the presidential campaign. I mean, you know, 4 years ago, Barack Obama, you know, if you looked at the top 10 employers of contributors to his campaign, five or six of them were too big to fail banks. You know, this time around, it's Mitt Romney's campaign, even though there are two on the president's list. And my prediction is that, you know, Wall Street, which has bet heavily on Mitt Romney, is going to start hedging that awfully quick. You know, so they're dominating our political system right now. We're moving towards a plutocracy. We have a plutocracy. I mean, the president's spending half his time, you know, raising money in $50,000 chunks from 100 millionaires. You know, he has to. He has no choice if he wants to compete with an incredibly well-funded Republican campaign. So neither side is likely to appoint the kinds of tough regulators that it would take to rein in Wall Street excess.
And, of course, as money becomes even more and more important in the political process, as the stakes become higher, we're going to see less and less focus on doing anything about this.
Yeah, I mean, even Warren Buffett, the great investor of Berkshire Hathaway said, democracies may simply tend toward plutocracy. And I'm not sure there's like a reverse gear on that. I mean, yes, we are still a democracy, but right now it looks like this perpetual money-raising machine that dominates Washington and that funds the careers of people in Washington. I don't know how you reverse that. Again, my greatest hope is that, you know, non-financial business will understand that it's in their interest to do something about it. I mean, there was one issue before Congress, you know, the swipe fees that credit cards charge at the retail level. I mean, Walmart and Home Depot and a lot of the big retailers got together and they formed a coalition, and they shocked, you know, the banks by actually getting 64 votes in favor of their amendment, you know, which shows that when big business gets organized, it can defeat Wall Street. But it takes power to beat power, and it's going to take enough people and enough non-financial corporations waking up in America and realizing, you know, we need Washington to protect the common business interest too, not just, you know, the special Wall Street interest.
This comes back to this idea that market forces ultimately are the only thing that's going to move Congress or move Washington. You had a particularly unique situation in working for Ted Kaufman, who was appointed and then said he wasn't going to run again, so that money was not an issue for him.
Right. I mean, he never had to raise a dime. I mean, he could be a full-time senator. Most senators are part-time senators because they have to spend so much of their time raising money. I know because I was a lobbyist. I mean, most senators start their day Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday when they're in town with a breakfast down on K Street trying to pick up 15 grand around a table of lobbyists. Ted never had to do that once. You know, I, as his chief of staff, never once had to either take a call from someone who had raised a lot of money from us, who was upset with the positions Ted was taking on Wall Street reform, nor did I ever have to make a call, you know, to someone on Wall Street and then, you know, get an earful of, you know, why should I raise money for Ted when he's, you know, out there arguing against our interests. So he does sort of serve as this unique example of what we might get if we took money out of politics. Now, he also was unique in that he had been Joe Biden's chief of staff for 20 years, had taught a course on Congress at Duke for 20 years, and remained an advisor for Biden. So he wasn't new to the Senate. He had been around the Senate for 36 years. I mean, he really did hit the ground running, and he had a MBA from Wharton in the 1960s, and he had been an investor for 50 years. So he was very savvy about these financial issues. But I used to call him Senator Rip Van Winkle because, you know, all these things he learned at Wharton in the 1960s, you know, the Glass-Steagall Act, you know, which separated commercial from investment banking, the uptick rule, which meant you couldn't short sell stocks unless you waited for an uptick in price, you know, and that was meant to prevent bear markets. All these things that he learned in the 60s had been repealed. And so he, you know, and Joe Biden really didn't focus on banking issues when Ted was his chief of staff. So when Ted started to look at these issues, he's like, what happened to all these things that we put in the law after the Great Depression that I learned about in business school that worked for decades? You know, they all got dismantled. And so he was really taking what I thought was a conservative view. You know, why don't we go back to what worked before? And the argument we heard over and over again was, well, it's too late. The eggs have already been scrambled. You know, Glass-Steagall's repeal didn't really have anything to do with it. You know, it was some of the small investment banks failed, too. And so all we got in financial reform was no bright lines, no, you know, statutory hard and fast rules. We got a bunch of, reshuffled regulatory powers and kicked it back to the same regulators who failed in the run-up to the crisis. You know, and now we have yet another set of, you know, multiple thousands of pages of regulations being written with Wall Street's help, you know, that probably are not going to be effective in the long run in preventing the next financial crisis.
Did Dodd-Frank make any difference?
Well, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau was a big win for the consumer, and, you know, that was in Dodd-Frank. Derivatives needed to be regulated and, you know, traded on a clearinghouse and through these types of trading facilities, the Dodd-Frank. So that, too, was important. And the Volcker Rule, you know, unless it gets loopholed to death, you know, which would ban banks from engaging in proprietary trading, that, too, too was important, but the provisions that were meant to address too big to fail were just obviously inadequate. And, you know, the idea that these big banks are going to write a living will, you know, so if they ever start to fail, they'll know how to dismantle themselves before they take down the financial system. I mean, it's implausible on its face. You know, the idea that, okay, our regulators needed resolution authority to resolve these banks when they fail, but these banks are global in scope, and U.S. laws, the jurisdiction of our laws, stop at the border. So why would anybody think that resolution authority is going to work? I mean, we're going to once again be in a situation where when one of these banks starts to go down, it would threaten to take other banks down with it, and we'll be in a bailout or go into a depression scenario again. So Ted thought the only answer was to break them up. You know, we need ex-ante solutions. You know, break them up so they're not as politically powerful, so that they can be permitted to fail without bringing down the entire banking system with them.
Is there a way to address some of these issues without breaking them up, without changing the way in which they are integrated to the global financial markets?
Well, this is what the Federal Reserve said to us. You know, we know what to do. We need to increase capital requirements. We need to coordinate it at the international level. You know, if we make capital requirements correlate with size, you know, then that will create an incentive for these banks to stop growing and maybe even to shrink. So, you know, that's what we're going to do, you know, at the regulatory level. And Ted said, okay, I've only got one question. You know, what's going to happen 2 years, 6 years, 10 years from now when a whole new set of regulators come into office? And you can't even tell me who they're going to be or what they're going to believe. I mean, what if they're free market ideologues who don't believe in regulating banks? You know, I think we need to do what our forebears did in the 1930s and pass lines in statute that are bright lines for regulators to implement, not leave it to the discretion of the very regulators who failed us in the lead-up to the crisis. And more people are now turning to the idea that we need bright lines as, you know, the foundation of our regulatory regime. I mean, Nicholas Brady, the Republican Treasury Secretary under both Ronald Reagan and George Bush I, wrote a piece in Financial Times saying, you know, we need to establish bright lines, like a leverage test. It's like, well, that, you know, where were you 3 years ago when Senator Kaufman and Senator Brown offered that amendment on the Senate floor? I mean, it got defeated. Only three Republicans voted for it. You know, no one wanted bright lines in the statute. They wanted complexity handed back to the regulators.
One of the things that we're seeing is a great deal of frustration on the part of regulators and many leaving their jobs for other pursuits, which weakens things still further.
Yeah, well, that's the revolving door. In fact, I've even heard one of the problems with prosecutors is that, you know, it takes so long to develop one of these complicated cases that a young prosecutor could work on a case for 2-3 years. You know, he really understands and masters the facts of that case, and then suddenly he's at a point in his life or her life when, you know, I want to go to work for a law firm now, you know. And so they cycle out, and then, you know, somebody else has to pick up the case, and they don't know the facts, you know, nearly as well. You know, I'm a hypocrite on this issue because I've been through the revolving door, you know, twice in my career. I mean, this is part of my book. I mean, you know, you have these thousands of young people moving to Washington every year with the best of intentions, just like I did 25 years ago. And you work for years when you get there in the public sector. And then you sort of hit your 30s and you're like, you know what? I don't have any assets. You know, I don't own a house. I'm driving a crappy car. You know, I'm getting into my mid-30s. I mean, you know, I need to go work in the private sector. And who's there to hire you? Wall Street and corporate America. You know, now there are not-for-profits, and there are hundreds and hundreds of people who continue to work very hard every day for low amounts of pay to try to do the right thing for the public interest. But they are vastly outnumbered by the legions of people, I call them professional Democrats. You know, I mean, people who basically put on the blue jersey and, you know, work for a while in the public sector, work for a while in the private sector, you know, always raising money for Democratic officials. Same thing's happening on the Republican side, trying to get a better job in the next administration and move their way up, you know, sort of pulling their way up the greasy pole of power in Washington and making a tremendous amount of money in the private sector as they do that. And that's, you know, that's the culture of the swamp. I mean, that's, you know, I ended up neck deep in that. But after seeing, after 2 years in the Senate, after the financial crisis, how badly the system had gotten out of whack, I was like, I cannot go back to that. I mean, I can't stay in Washington. I cannot remain silent and be an accomplice, you know, to the Justice Department and this stain on our justice system by failing to investigate. So I literally left town so I could tell the truth. I mean, you can't stay in Washington and tell the truth and expect to make a living, you know. So I just felt like I had to go off and sort of mutiny from the bounty. That was one of the potential titles for my book. And call the Justice Department out and others in Washington for not doing enough after this once in 60 years crisis that shocked my conscience and should have shocked, you know, the consciences of a lot more people in Washington.
Is it your sense that another crisis will happen sometime in our lifetime?
Well, Ted, who was also a mechanical engineer by training, used to say, you know, when you build a rocket with a flawed design and the rocket blows up on the launching pad, and then you build a new rocket using the same design, I mean, what do you think's going to happen when you light the fuse? I mean, it's not going to take off. It's going to blow up again. I mean, you know, we haven't done enough to change the design. Now, I think, you know, the regulators are very chastened by the last crisis. It's still fresh in most people's memories. But, you know, Mitt Romney, if he were elected president, and I'm trying to be as nonpartisan as possible, but, I mean, Mitt Romney has said, I want regulators to be friends of business, you know, and I think I know what he means by that. I mean, he doesn't want excessive, burdensome regulation, but, you know, he needs to know that regulators play an important role in stopping banks from committing lawless activities, you know. I mean, we need regulators. So it may not be long before we have another set of regulators that just basically let the banks do whatever they want to do. And if that's the case, yes. You know, I mean, even when they signed Dodd-Frank, I mean, Treasury Secretary Geithner, Senator Dodd, none of them said, we'll never again have another financial crisis. I mean, they know videotape lasts a long time. So, yes, we'll have another financial crisis, and, you know, that's probably what it's going to take before we'll get real change in this country.
Jeff Conaton, the book is The Payoff, Why Wall Street Always Wins. Jeff, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you, Jeff. I appreciate it.
Thank you.